I apologize for moving you over here and this last bit of hike, which was not expected. Hi there, there are some handouts over there. This is embodied care. Jewelry making is at Creekside because this is not a good setting for making jewelry. Wallace realized that the tables here were not sturdy enough for the power tools that they need for jewelry making. And so we were scrambling last minute, but at home, everything.
Power tools.
Power tools. I found so
many coconuts.
In light of that, then we just decided to switch rooms. I want to actually start. Don't give up my original here. Does anybody have my? It's like just one page.
Yeah, to the bottom
here.
Hey, Michelle.
Hey.
Jewelry making's back.
No, she's here with us.
She has her Haiti already.
So I asked Michelle to actually come to this session today. I stole her away from jewelry making because I want to talk about coconut theology. And coconut theology is kind of like taking the Word of God as a coconut. And one of the things that the Brazilian learns very early in her life is that coconuts are one of God's most perfect resources. I mean, if you have an upset stomach, you drink coconut water. It has all the electrolytes that you need. And of course, you can also have it the drink at the beach. You know, pina coladas are great. And so we learned very early in our lives that coconuts are very good things, and especially for nourishment, for entertainment. They are part of the goodness of God's creation to us. But coconuts, when they are green, when they mature, and then we can actually eat the inside pulp, when the milk, the coconut water dries into the pulp, then you have that magnificent black shell. And there is no way that you're going to eat the inside of a coconut without breaking the shell. So in thinking about coconut theology, thinking about the brokenness of the world and everything, all the pieces that are constantly shattered, and yet how during the week we have learned to find meaning in a shattered world, in situations when things just fall apart, and redefining what has happened to us in a way that allows us then to also move forward. I asked Michelle to share with us and tell us a little bit about the beautiful work that she has done in jewelry making. Can you do that?
So the coconut shells are leftovers from actual coconuts that were used. The shells are broken, and so you can continue to break them down into a manageable size, just about that size. And then you can trace or draw your own shape on them, whatever you want. And I chose Haiti. And so what you do is you have to draw the pattern and then take a handsaw and actually hold the coconut down. Wow. And very, very meticulously saw around this with this little tiny blade, you saw the coconut shell. And so it has a lot of, I think, you know, spiritual and emotional meanings to it as you're doing it. So you're cutting around your shape and the coconut is dried, and so you're breaking off the pieces and cutting out your shape. And then once you do that, before you have to do that, you have to take one, you know, you use the coconut as a tool. So the one coconut you use one coconut to shave off the little hairs of the other coconut. So you're using coconut on coconut to shave off the hairs. So it's pretty good.
No splinters.
No splinters, right? And so, and then you cut the coconut. And so then you, so then after it's all done, you can use some tools to flatten it out and make it, you know, smoother and stuff like that. And then you just make a necklace or earrings out of it. And so you can choose to varnish it or not varnish it. It's up to you.
So. That was such a beautiful metaphor, you know, for theology and for life and what we do with the adversities and how we rename our own histories and memories and how we move forward. From my own personal experience, I have always worn this black piece of jewelry on my fingers, and that is also made of coconut, and so that is, you know, my participation in coconut theology. I did my internship in the Amazon area with a Roman Catholic bishop by the name of Dom Pedro Casaldáliga. And Dom Pedro Casaldáliga was very much in tune with the plight of the poor and the disenfranchised of the Amazon area. And when he was appointed bishop, and you know, if you know anything about, you know, when people are actually placed in a position as a bishop, this is a very big ceremony, and a bishop is given, you know, that pointy hat. There's a staff. There's this huge golden ring with a very expensive stone on it to symbolize, ironically, service. Dom Pedro Casaldáliga made this very clear that that is not how he wanted to be a bishop, and so he decided to, in the ceremony, go with his regular everyday clothes. He would wear a stole, but as a sign of service. But instead of the pointy hat, he used his regular straw hat, which is also the same hats that landless peasants use in the Amazon area. Even though we have one of the largest size countries in the world, the gap between the people who actually have land and the landless peasants is very big. 5% of the population owns just about 60% of the land, if you are not counting national forests and parks and public owned land. So there's a lot of people without land, and in an economy that depends very much on agriculture, that's very, very hard. And then, instead of his staff, he decided to use an oar, because at the fringe of one of the Amazon rivers, there are many fishing communities that live by basically just from fishing. And so in solidarity with those people, with that community, and he wanted to be a pastor to them, he walked into church with an oar. And instead of a golden ring, he then had a coconut ring, because this is made by a particular indigenous group from that area of Goiás, where he was located. And so pretty much if you see a Brazilian with a black ring, you can ask, and it has some sort of affiliation with this type of movement. It's called the Church from Below, you know, the grassroots Christian-based movement. So much about coconut theology. Thank you so much, Michelle, for sharing this with us. I brought you a handout, and what we could do is to read portions of this and comment about it, if that suits you. There are a couple of people who have really wonderful, wonderful insights, and we will just wait for you to share those insights with us. Can I have somebody ask to read the two first paragraphs of this handout?
Sure.
Thank you so much.
The foundation of Christianity is Jesus, the incarnate Word. God made human beings in God's image and became human to live in our midst. The divine becomes human to inhabit and walk among its creatures, to reveal its love for humankind and to stand in solidarity with the whole creation. The testimony about God's embodied care for humanity is the center of the Christian message, and that is good news, gospel. In his life, death, and resurrection, Jesus the Christ embodies the reign of God.
Basileia, that's a... I just was show offish, you know, I was saying that that's the Greek word for it, you know, Basileia, but you know, you could just have skipped it. Sorry.
That's okay. I like that. Ministering in favor of all people, but particularly the excluded, explored, and those whose dignity is recognized. Yes.
Is that supposed to be exploited?
Yeah, exploited, yes. Oh. Thank you.
It's funny, when I read that word, I thought of indigenous people who...
Yeah, explorers. Yeah.
Explorers.
Yeah.
Explorers.
Yeah.
Explorers. Thank you. Explore and exploit.
Yeah.
Jesus assumes humanity in its totality. Through miracles, cures, and preaching, he gives example of a life commitment that is geared toward physical and spiritual well-being.
One more?
I'm good.
In his own body, Jesus also feels physical pain and death. God's revelation is experienced also through a body in pain, and not only in the healthy and aesthetically idealized body. Having known suffering, God can know how human beings suffer. The suffering of Christ is not a divine tacit consent of pain and denial of the body. Instead, it is the ultimate result of passion, of a divine love that goes until the end, which assumes the body as place of revelation, also in the moment of pain and suffering. Through the cross, the deity reveals its passion for humanity in coherence to a life of testimonies and actions in favor of human dignity. To assume the body implies in suffering in his own body the consequences of his position. Hunger, thirst, fatigue, and pain are also part of embodiment. It is the suffering body that requires salvation, the proclamation of good news.
What does that evoke in you? I mean, any ideas? Biblical passages, personal narrative?
Well, I can talk about my life.
I experience
my suffering from the standpoint of the part of me that's connected to the Divine Mother.
Mm-hmm.
More than through Jesus. I'm not a Christian, a Lutheran. I'm totally out of the box. My husband was raised Lutheran, so this Holden Village has been a beautiful place, and he always wanted me to bring me here. But I experience a deep grief for everything that the earth is suffering, everything that humanity is suffering, as a piece of the Divine Mother, as I attempt to get breath through this body that is Sarah, I go through tremendous grief at the separation, as if I'm breathing in the dead earth or the rioted earthquake land, I really feel that as the divine feeling the core agony of separation. I've been 27 and a half years in the path of really deep, really, really deep work to help the earth and all humanity. And so as I read this passage, and I often call on Jesus, because I feel I'm very connected to that lineage, and that he understands and knows what I'm going through, and I call on Mary, too. And so for me, this, especially the second passage that I was reading, is very meaningful, because I think it's tempting, or it's kind of, for a long time I thought, oh, the divine is above suffering. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go through it. And then this life with mine started happening, and I realized, oh my God, you know, the most beautiful aspects of God and Goddess grieve
as they encounter the separation consciousness of the physical flesh, as they are embodying, you know, they do, they grieve. They don't fear, but they grieve. And so I've been crying a lot today, just feeling that, just so I can breathe enough to walk and move. Because the earth is going through massive transformation right now, and my body is a big part of that. So that's, yeah. That's why when I saw you at lunch, I was like, that's my life. I know that topic. Yeah.
And it is really sad that it took us basically 20 centuries of Christian teachings to be able to acknowledge that at the cross, it is not only the human aspect of Christ, the human nature in Jesus that is actually suffering, but it is God suffering.
Absolutely.
As I was saying in our conversation yesterday, Patripassianism has been considered a heresy to say that God the Father, the Creator, would also be suffering with creation, because there needs to be that distance, as if God had created the world and standing ex machina, you know, kind of like looking at from it outside, now you deal with whatever. But there is that connection, because this is also God's body. Creation, nature, the cosmos is also God's body. And so, of course, there is suffering of the creature, but then there's also, which is, of course, transmitted also to the Creator. And that has taken us a very long time to come to terms with. They say that if a butterfly moves its wings in one part of the world, then you feel a breeze. Mm-hmm. Elsewhere, that we are all intimately connected with what happens, but we tend to think of the world and our own lives, our own reality, as so separate from everything that happens in the world. And honestly, it is simpler, it seems less complicated, and it is less painful, less engaging to have to proceed with that mentality that separates us. But if we are true and honest to our own creation, to being creatures and part of this wider creation, then you also need to acknowledge that.
Well, that brings to mind for me about Jesus in particular, how I also feel like it's easier for some people to imagine that Jesus was not fully human. Right. Because to hold this balance of God's only Son, words that you can see somewhat frequently in Scripture, and Jesus' full humanity with brothers and sisters, and you know, the poem I was looking at that you had yesterday,
yes.
Jesus, thinking of Jesus' body, parts, you know, it's hard for people to just really go for the total humanity of Jesus Christ. What does that mean?
And what we have in Jesus is this being completely human and completely divine. And all of the heresies that, you know, the accusations, the pointing of fingers that happened in the first centuries, pointing out that, well, if, of course, Jesus cannot be fully divine because he died, and God cannot die. But let's learn from Jesus' ministry, and this is, you know, what Jesus did, and let's follow that. And some other people would say, Jesus could not be fully human, you know, like Docetists. They said, well, Jesus just pretended to be human. Jesus just pretended to die because God cannot die, and which takes away all the power of the cross and of resurrection. Something that is not really truly dead cannot resurrect, and that would remove all the power of that. And so we have had basically the first four centuries, or five centuries of Christian history, you know, with that pointing of finger and mutual accusation and calling each other heretics, which I don't think was very productive. And in the meantime, of course, Constantine gets to become the emperor, and Christianity just becomes more and more domesticated in its role, in its prophetic role. So,
Do we want to read the next two paragraphs? Can somebody read that?
Thank you. A body on a cross reminds us of suffering bodies. God does not deny nor ignore suffering. In the midst of pain, exposed to violence, flogged, and expropriated from its dignity, Jesus' body is on the cross. Yet the cross is also the beginning of resurrection. Standing by the cross are Jesus' mother, his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, Mary Magdalene, and the beloved disciple. This is the group that neither betrayed nor denied him, who didn't flee or abandon him. Not often do we speak about the feeling of loss and desperation that Jesus' closest friends and followers felt. They witnessed Jesus' suffering and suffered with him. Shared pain gives place to hope and is the beginning of resurrection. Lent season was the time in the early church when new members educated in the faith were baptized. There was a purpose for that. Christians were baptized into a church that suffered persecution and knew what being an outcast meant. They chose to belong to a church that recognized the suffering world, yet publicly announced that no more sacrificial deaths were necessary. We can only imagine the sense of emptiness of being baptized into a church whose God has just died. Christians were not baptized into a theology of glory, prosperity, or heavenly compensations for earthly suffering, but into a theology of the cross. Following the example of Jesus, believers knew pain, but believed that faith, love, and hope would ultimately prevail. To announce the good news of the reign of God, Christians could count on others like Mary, Mary Magdalene, the wife of Clopas, and the beloved disciple, who had the courage to witness their faith publicly.
So, one of the things that always strikes me, and it is true to a certain extent, that a lot of the prayers that deal with passion speak from the standpoint of Peter, or the disciples who just ran away and hid. And a lot of the prayers start with, "Forgive us, Lord, because we betrayed you, we denied you three times, because we just hid, because we were not courageous." And it has really taken a while, and this has happened only recently, that we talk about the event of the cross, and we dare, similar to the Bible studies on Lamentation, to say we are mourning because there is a loss that we have felt. Our beloved friend is no longer here. Instead of just taking that stance, "We betrayed you," say, "Here we are, the community that was left behind. And yet, we were with you until the very end." And that gives a very different view also of what the ministry of accompaniment is all about. Because if you think about the community that stands until the very end, does not run away, but is able to pull through, to live the whole situation as it is, and even though it is very painful, standing there at the foot of the cross. And for me, that is where resurrection actually begins. Resurrection is not an event that happens Sunday morning. Resurrection begins with that community that affirms life and support and saying, "We are here with you, and here is my shoulder for you to cry on." Mm-hmm. And for me, that is a powerful way also of understanding that when we every Sunday confess our faith and use the words of the creed and say, "I believe in the resurrection of the body," we say that every Sunday, okay, that this is what it means. We cannot have that fully at this point with all the people who are no longer with us, but that we can experience it. The beginning of it is already that solidarity that we experience with one another.
comment.
I
like that you have a list of all the people, but I think you forgot my favorite person at the cross, who is a soldier who says, "Truly, this man is the Son of God." He's a soldier who probably didn't really know that much about Jesus' life and teaching, and he sees a person up on a cross killed, and his response is, "This is the Son of God," and that does not make a lot of sense, and I can't understand that, and that's grace, so that's something else. Mm-hmm. But what that does make me think of is that when we see another person in pain, I can imagine that he felt pain himself, and that pain can draw us out of ourselves and feel for other people, kind of a ecstatic experience. And so, just as often as pain and suffering can cause a crisis of faith, mm-hmm. it can also draw us out of ourselves mm-hmm. into faith, both in God and into a community of sorts.
Resurrection begins when Jesus' closest friends stand by him at the cross and display their pain. They can only weep in solidarity with the mourner. To weep is a powerful act, most often dismissed for its subjectivity and confused with passivity. Mary Magdalene's tears, for instance, are never seen as a political act. Mary stood weeping outside the tomb, John 20:11. But to cry in public for Jesus meant that she identified with a political outcast. The cross was used as a tool for torture and death for political and social criminals. Jesus' body on the cross unsettles and troubles us because it confronts us with our own humanity. But do we allow suffering? To cry shows that we are not immune to other people's suffering, but that in solidarity, we want to extend our hand and help change that situation. Solidarity and love transforms the cross into a tree of life. In early Christian writings, Jesus' crucifixion is not always described as a divine will or as an expiatory sacrifice, as stated by a theology of atonement. Suffering does not result from a tacit divine consent, but it is the final result of passion. At the cross, Jesus reveals his love for humanity and his commitment to feel all that human beings feel, including death. Why does the divine, being able to avoid the suffering imposed to the body, choose to suffer until the end? Why was Jesus not satisfied with the pleasures of the body, but included in his life also hunger, thirst, fatigue, and physical pain? Why does God's human body take on humanity in its totality, including death? This is the mystery suspended on the cross. At the cross, passion becomes concrete, and the resurrection becomes possible. 1 Corinthians 1:18-35.
So, a couple of ideas I wanted to share with you. First, comes from a poem from a Spanish political refugee who had to settle in Mexico called Felipe de Calderón. And he has this beautiful poem in which he says that he has cried many tears, and there's so much pain in his own life trajectory, but that by seeing the world with tears in your eyes, you see the world distorted. when you have tears in your eyes, I don't know if you have ever tried this, but everything gets blurry, right? Mm-hmm. So the world is very distorted. But Felipe de Calderón says, even though the world is distorted, what I see is more accurate. So to see the world through the lens of the tear makes us see the world in a more accurate manner. It does not always correspond to facts, but we see the world from a different perspective. Because if you see the world from the perspective of pain, you can also make a different connection with what is outside you, because you will have eyes for things that other people do not have eyes for. And it is very deeply connected with this beautiful song that we have been singing every morning about the secrets that are kept from us and the lies that are just told. And what that freedom entails is that you can actually choose sides, and choosing the side of somebody who is most vulnerable, most needy, most in somebody who really requires our intervention and solidarity and care. And so this builds in with the whole notion that what we do also as Christians in terms of embodied care is to look out for those who are more vulnerable, because we do that through the perspective of having tears in our eyes. And even though we might sometimes, people say, well, you know, this is not always very factual, but this is how we do it in a way that is accurate. The symbology, of course, of tears, we tend to dismiss tears as always a sign of passivity. You know, this is what women do, you know, they're always weeping. This is what children do, they're always crying. And we dismiss tears because we do not see them in their deeper theological meaning as well. And in Mary Magdalene's case, there could not be anything more dangerous to than to shed tears for somebody who was persecuted politically. And to give that public witness of solidarity, as opposed to just say, deny him three times, or let's just hide, we don't even know who that person was, but to jeopardize one's own life and well-being because that pain is so overwhelming that you cannot escape but to acknowledge that pain publicly. And doing that becomes an extremely dangerous and yet also, I would say, an ultimate sign of discipleship and love that we have witnessed here in the tears that are shared by Mary Magdalene. And I want to throw this out there. There's only one sentence here, but I think that when the cross is watered by tears, and when these tears happen in community, watering the cross with our communal tears, that cross becomes a tree of life. How can that happen? I've been profoundly intrigued by the concept of how the cross becomes a tree of life. And there are beautiful imagery that dates from the 12th, 13th century, in which people would indeed have crosses that resemble trees of life. Because the cross is also a tree of life in the sense that it gives us new life. It inspires us to strive for life and abundance for others. It remits us to that first tree in the Garden of Eden, but then the tree that is alluded to in the book of Revelation for the healing of the nations. And so how does that tree become then the center of our ministry? The cross wasn't always the main symbol for Christianity. We know that the fish is used. People who are experts in scripture will point out that in the early catacombs, many Christians identify much more with the shepherd's staff, you know, as the good shepherd who is now guiding us. But it is, and the cross was introduced into Christianity much more as a caricature. You know, people from outside say, oh, look, those are the Christians. You know, they meet around this guy who is crucified. And Christians said, indeed, this is who we are. Very much like queer theology has done. You know, just switch something around and say, yep, that's who we are. And just work with it. But I think there's some really beautiful possibilities for us to reclaim that also in our worship. And so I'm thinking about Mary here.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, Wanda, because I've been helping out with the worship class at Luther Seminary, just doing helping people think about music. And one of the things that they do for their big assignment there is to do the 3 days, Monday, Thursday, Good Friday, and the vigil at the end of class. They do it all in one day in a sort of a retreat setting. But Good Friday, many of us who've been talking about the 3 days for a lot of times, has ended up being one of the hardest services because it's gone through so many different permutations of people doing the seven last words, you know, now coming up with new resources, having these old prayers and this long prayer service with so many words in it. If you read the whole gospel story, the passion story, and then you do all the reading prayers, and then you do the self reproaches, and you know, like, what is the point? What are we doing here? And then there's people who want to just watch a sort of a play and think about it kind of historically and cry along with these followers of Jesus. So we've been talking about this image of the tree of life and what that all brings us to. If you are looking at Good Friday being that, as you've said here, the passion is the first start of the resurrection, so keep looking forward.
Okay. Can I ask you to share your story with us?
Sure. Well, many of you know my husband is paraplegic, and he became paraplegic when we were church planters in Japan. And from a root canal, the staph infection was introduced into his system, and the infection lodged on the epidural of his spinal cord and paralyzed him. And we had a lot, every missionary in Japan came to his hospital room. For one reason or another, not everybody has a theology of the cross, and so, and a lot of people came to pray for him for physical healing. And he, and then over time, he got a lot of questions about, do you ever ask why you, or do you ever think, oh, I wish this had never happened to me? And his answer, early on in this new way of life that he was living, was, you know, before I was paralyzed, I experienced grace in my life. Like if you turn on the kitchen tap, that amount of water that runs out. But he said, you know, I grew up near Niagara Falls, and since I've been paralyzed, the grace of God in my life has been like Niagara Falls. And I made a little note here. One of my favorite Bible verses is from Titus chapter 2. The grace of God appeared, bringing salvation. And I think when we talk about the grace of God in our life, we need to understand that that grace of God is Jesus. It's Jesus who appeared, bringing salvation. And Philip said to me this morning, he said, I'm sure a lot of people have said to you over the years, oh, your husband is so lucky to have you. But he said, I want you to know today that you are so lucky to have your husband. And true enough, because I've learned so much from him through this.
Wanda, you slipped in a terribly important idea for me, and I assume that, I don't know how far you want to go with it, but the expiatory sacrifice, which, you know, came with Anselm in the 12th century. And I just want to give testimony to the positive thing that you talk about in terms of the crucifixion being the final result of passion, not as the substitutionary sacrifice that I grew up with and for many years preached, and found that in the exact time of crying on Good Friday, in the hopes that my tears will forgive my sins and I'll get to heaven. But as you say, the resurrection begins now, as Christ suffers with us more than for us. So, thank you.
Do you want to read the next paragraph, just the next one?
Sure. That's the sharing of the body of Christ as food in the sacrament of the communion, Holy Supper, is a visible testimony of this theology. The broken body is shared to fortify other bodies, announcing resurrection. The communitarian dimension of sharing, evoked in the Last Supper, announces that Christ himself is the bread and the fruit of the grapevine. When we do it, we testify his ministry in favor of the reign of God and his passion for humanity. We affirm incarnation and resurrection. We anticipate life's fullness, the joy and happiness that the forgiveness of sins given to us by God propitiates us. The broken and tortured body of Jesus becomes food for us as memory and commitment that no other human sacrifices are necessary. The food that we eat and the drink that we take strengthen us to testify the good news of forgiveness, reconciliation, and solidarity that no more suffering is needed.
So, does this echo what you understand as the sacrament of the Eucharist, or what do you experience when you come to the table and you partake of the Lord's Supper? I know not everybody is different, and you know, maybe that this is not a very, you know, every or a weekly experience for you, but still, if you want to share? Yes, please.
I get in trouble at the Lord's Supper.
No.
Well, because I get to serve chalice, and it's my favorite time of the week to have that honor and to have that privilege to feed my friends, to feed those that I know and those that I don't know. Well, she's no longer a priest at our church anymore, but I also got shushed a lot just because I was too loud or I was too joyous, and I thought, oh my God, you don't get it. And so she's now gone, and so now I'm louder and happier at the table. But it's my favorite time of the week, especially when I get to serve, because it just is.
Awesome. My daughter used to go away from the table, and she was skipping, you know, she was literally dancing. Yeah. And I thought, you know, you got it. So, yeah. Other experiences?
Yes, well, I serve a parish in Mandan, North Dakota, and it's a pretty unique parish because the congregation doesn't own its own building, but worships on the campus of the North Dakota Youth Correctional Center. And so for 30 years, the people of the congregation are committed to worshiping with incarcerated youth from all across the state. Mm-hmm. And many of them are multiracial or Native American. And so, as you can imagine, there's much, much pain and suffering in that background. But what perplexes me at the table at Heart River is that we involve the students in every aspect of the service, from reading to being ushers to sometimes accompanying with music to being communion servers. And so what's very amazing to me is that I have four youth who serve communion to everybody, and including their guards. And so it's, wow, it's, you know, it just blows me away, and it never ceases to blow me away. And we serve communion to the littlest ones on down. And so to see them kind of kneel down for these little ones who come for communion is just a very powerful, a powerful thing. And after worship, they go back into their cell with the guards that they simply gave communion to as well. It's very, very powerful. So I'm thinking about that in new ways since I've been serving there. But I think for me personally, Holy Communion is something that is shared beyond those who are physically present. And I really don't understand the Communion of Saints. I know we confess it. I don't understand it, but for some reason I always try and think of those who have died and somehow being united to them. It's very powerful for me.
I have some unique experience with that. Before I came here, I went to the churches that I've gone to, and the one that I go to, they just serve communion. It cracks me up now that I've been here. I'm hysterical. I just want to change our whole communion practice. We're like this four square Pentecostal. I'm like, we gotta be Lutheran about this. or at least Holden, or however, I don't know. But we just serve it this like these round platters, and just break these crackers up, and then they have these little holes where the grape juice goes in, and just pass it along the pews, and you're like, kind of lame now that I've been here. And so now that I've been here, I've been trained as a sacristan, learned what that meant, been a communion assistant. But I've had hysterical things happen to me. Pour the wine into these little bitty cups, poured it on people's hands. I just, you know, I've had so much grace here, you know. And but I love it here. It's just great. And so if you're here Sunday, you can be a sacristan, you'll learn, see if you can try to figure that out. But I love the communion practice here. And it sounds like that I hear, listen, that's just generally how Lutheran people do it. And so I think it's wonderful. I'm going to take that back. I agree. This paragraph, I know you're talking about, but this is how this is what it means to me. When I take communion, this is what it really nails it down here for me, that's what, you know, it's all about when Jesus died. This paragraph says it all.
You know, the sacrament really, even though I think it's the most embodied sacrament, mm-hmm. we talk about the body and the blood of Christ.
Yeah.
It really goes beyond time and space.
Mm-hmm.
Because it connects us to the community, the cloud of witness before us. And yet, it's also geared towards the future. It's scatological. It's almost like having a homesickness for something that has not yet happened. You know, longing for a taste that you have not yet experienced, and yet you already have it. That in Christ we have that, number one, Jesus Christ is the one offering, is the one saying, this is my body and my blood. So almost like the waiter who comes to you, okay? This is what is being served. But then, this is also the meal. We are eating that body and that blood. And then Christ is also the community taking it. And in which you look at the people around you and you see Christ stamped on each other's face. So we are also Christ to one another. And so it really escapes time and place, and yet it is so rooted, so grounded on what is happening in the sacrament as it is.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Well, I realize how much I can't say my understanding because it's a mystery, but how through the years I think of working with the garbage people in Cairo, and you know, the Orthodox, if anyone has ever worshipped with the Orthodox, they're very, very noisy. Everyone's talking to each other, they go out for coffee outside, and but as it comes closer to the Eucharist, the church becomes quiet. And they see this as the closest to heaven that you will be on earth. Mm-hmm. And it is so sacred. And so to worship with the garbage people, where when I first walked into the church and the smells were just permeating every wall, and even though I was not allowed to go to the communion table, somehow working to that holy moment, I never once after that would go to the garbage village and smell the garbage. Mm-hmm. It became sacred for me. And just a few Sundays ago, the priest in our church said, you know, sometimes we talk about that at the Eucharist, it becomes the body and blood of Christ. And of course, Catholics think it a little bit differently. I always say it just happens at a different time. Catholics believe it happens when the priest blesses it. We believe it is when we take the wine and the bread. But he said, always remember to bathe yourself in that knowledge that just like it's a mystery how it becomes the body and blood of Christ, it's a mystery how we become the body and blood of Christ. Mm-hmm. Take it a step further. Mm-hmm. And it's just like over the years, it's just become more and more mm-hmm. important.
You know, I was going back and looking while she was talking how we become, you know, you were talking about that the crucifixion actually is the beginning, that the pain is actually the beginning of new life. And I was thinking, life for us as human beings doesn't begin without pain. The process of birth, it's painful. And I also think that if it's for those that the bodies that endure and suffer through and make it through truly a vaginal birth, most of them undergo a physical transformation, particularly in the shape of the head. And so I was just thinking that that life itself begins in pain, and here it's a manifestation in the body of Christ, ending in pain to be yet begin in pain. So it's just an interesting.
And everything that would otherwise be taboo and not considered clean enough is now elevated to the level of sacred. That people who work in garbage are now saints. Mm-hmm. That everyday meals, such as bread and wine, are sacramental, and that we are capable of taking the mundane and saying, how can we find the presence of God in the midst of these things? You do not have to go up on a mountain to find God, because God has already found you in your everyday reality. And these very common elements that translate for us what it means to also find God in us and how God is manifested in our everyday life. Somebody want to read that last paragraph?
The Easter celebration culminates with the resurrection of Jesus, the Christ. The care for the body led to its discovery. When Mary Magdalene, along with other women, goes to tend to the dead body of Jesus, she encounters the resurrected one. The care for the body of Jesus is what prompts the good news to the whole community, as she is commanded to go and announce the resurrection. Mary Magdalene had, in the first centuries, the title Apostola Apostolorum, the Apostle to the Apostles, because as the first witness of the resurrection, she had been commissioned by Jesus Christ to go and announce the good news. It is expected that Christians do the same.
So usually we want to find God in places that are very tough, and here we find the living God doing something very menial, and which people would dismiss and say, well, you know, this is not worthy of my time, my energy, my education, whatever. And that is exactly the place where you would find the resurrected one. And sometimes in the very core of the reality of death is where we find life. If we just run away from it, then we do not need to come to terms with it. And yet that fear will always continue lingering. And it takes such power over us that we cannot even name our fear and pain anymore. And then coming to dwell in it and visiting the grave and saying, I have to take care of this body, the body of my beloved friend, of my teacher, the one for whom I am willing to take risks and to take, to tend for what seems to be a lifeless body, and then that occasion, that opportunity, you find the resurrected Christ.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Given what you said there, why did you say the Easter celebration culminates with the resurrection of Jesus? I would have thought you say the Easter celebration begins with the resurrection of Jesus.
I think because I had said earlier that the resurrection begins already at the foot of the cross, and that resurrection then will find its fulfillment, fruition. I mean, will come to the actual resurrection on Sunday. And if you can find a better way of saying it, I explained yesterday that this is not my first language, so I appreciate it.
Yeah, but I guess that I would say, at least within the, let's say, our liturgical tradition, it begins on Easter Sunday and kind of culminates on Pentecost, right? It takes us 50 days, I mean, it's a 50-day party.
And it continues, right?
I mean, as you've been talking about the Lord's Supper, if that is always, that is the ongoing feast of the resurrection, and also that's why I'm saying I wouldn't think it culminates.
Talk about Jesus' resurrection, actual resurrection, but then to which extent what happens at Pentecost is that a resurrection of everybody's body? No, that is our own process, and we will fully experience that resurrection of the body when Jesus comes. But I would much rather emphasize that the process, that the renewal that is actually necessary, and the constant nourishment that we also need as bread for the journey, you know, whether it be through the sacrament of the Holy Supper or the renewal of baptism, everything that allows us to live in community and to better serve a neighbor. So I think it can be phrased in both ways, and yet I would prefer something that shows us that process. What happens in Pentecost is one marker. It's a very important marker for the church as it is. But the Holy Spirit was not only present there. And how can we then identify that before, during, and after? See, it's a little bit more geared towards the process and the ongoing reality of the sacrament that I would be emphasizing. Yes, please.
All right, so at the risk of embarrassing myself as a pastor's daughter and my biblical knowledge, I can see the culmination, because are Jesus' last words not, it is finished, and then his very next words are the commissioning to somebody else. So he's done. I mean, he's not. But in my mind, it's culminating. He started here, he finished here, and from here to here is then us. So his last words are, it is finished, I am done, and his next words are to Mary, to go forth and spread the news. Then we start a whole new process all over. I mean, that's a simplification in my mind as an illiterate preacher's daughter, but I just...
What?
You just said he's illiterate.
And that's the problem. But I can see where it culminates. I mean, everything has to come to a point of explosion or festering or celebration. Nothing can remain stagnant. If it does, then it simply dies. So it has to culminate. It has to explode, and it has to terminate. And I can see where that culmination comes in the life and the sacrifice of Jesus. And then it moves on.
I so appreciate, you know, you people are wonderful in terms of helping craft words, you know, like you're craftsmiths here. And for me, when something culminates, it might give the impression that, well, it is this high, it can only, you know, go lower now, and that's the end of it. It culminates, and, you know, then it's the end of it. So is there a word in English which means, you know, this is maybe a high point, and we will continue to have such high points, you know, in our own faith tradition, that we have these moments in our the history of the church, and we have that in the history of the people of God. Are there...
Other than a climax.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there other words for that?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to figure out with this sentence too. Is what you want to change is the word culminate, or is do you want to change the word Easter celebration? Like I was trying to think of.
I want to change culminate.
Yeah.
Right.
But I get what you're saying on that about the Good Friday to Easter Sunday trajectory. Because what's new about that to a lot of people is that the Good Friday is sort of the start of the resurrection in some ways, as opposed to sort of the
end. I would support that. Mary,
it's that old question, what happened in those 3 days?
Is the affirmation of the cross Easter morning, or is the affirmation of the cross Pentecost?
Mm-hmm. Or how about Good Friday?
Yeah. Well, the cross on Good Friday, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, the Good Friday.
What's the affirmation of what takes place?
Her statement about affirming the reign of God through the passion of Jesus. I don't know progressively, but there's a sense in which because the cross defeats the reign of Caesar and the world and the violence that crucified him, thus the reign of God that begins right there culminates on Easter. There might be a better word, but...
Comes to fruition.
Mm-hmm. I don't have any trouble with the idea that somehow nascent resurrection is incipient.
when you go home, if you decide not to put these pieces of paper into the recycling bin, if you do look at them at home, you will have memories of the engaging theological conversations we had here. And I think it has been a tremendous week to talk about personal experiences, our theology of the cross, how do we relate to that with our embodied selves, and also how a theology that honors all of that can help us move forward into the world being nourished by word and sacrament, but in our particular case, being nourished also by the wonderful stories that we have of people who have also shared them with us throughout this week, and be inspired to go and following Jesus' ministry, be disciples, and act likewise. Thank you so much for your time, for your patience, for your energy, for putting up with my terrible Brazilian accent. and even, you know, taking time to
to improve the simple handouts that I have prepared for you. So thank you. It has been a humbling experience getting to know you. Those of you whom I have a chance to talk to, I have been truly honored and humbled by what it is that you're doing out in the world. So thank you so much. And give yourselves a hand, because
thank you.